What I've tried to share with you is the main argument against what is called fundamentalism, and I won't delay on this because it's a thing I tend to get a bit wrapped caught in. Fundamentalism, I think, could be defined as the unawareness, really, of what I've shared with you tonight. The presumption that history in the first century was the same as history today. And the presumption that the New Testament is a photographic record and a tape recording of Jesus' actual words and actual things as they were there. It ignores all that Henry Newman has put there and other matter that I'll share with you later when I get on to some of the church. It ignores the kind of language of love that certainly we tend to use when we want to write meaningfully and communicate about someone we love, and it ignores the whole process of history writing in an imaginative world of the first century, which didn't make the refined distinctions that are good and that we now make today. Therefore, a fundamentalist will demand, for example, strictly speaking, that God made the world in 7 days, you know, that it was a rib of Adam that made Eve, and so it goes on, hurtling into stupidities and taking this beautiful book into reducing it down to what our little tiny minds can somehow kind of hold for insecurity, when it's the largest and loveliest art gallery in the world we're entering. And if you enter an art gallery, you've got to be humble. You've got to learn. You've got to tug an Aborigine by the sleeve and say, well, if they've got a sleeve, and say, hey, what's that mean in your culture? Or you've got to take a Greek, when you look at a Greek icon, and say, what's the meaning of that? Because you don't know. You've got to steep yourself in a culture, haven't you, to get the feel of what they're communicating to you. On the opposite side, then, to move on, from the credulity, which it is, I believe, of what's called fundamentalism, there's another thing that I want to now spend time that comes up in relation to the New Testament as a source for historical information about the real Jesus. And that's skepticism. It is true, and I've actually given you a page with this material on it to read later, so what I'm going to say now is better put there at the different stages of development of the New Testament. I've got a statement there by Raymond Brown, a statement from the Biblical Commission, Pontifical Commission, and then a statement by me. Take your pick, or put them all together. But the point I'm making is very simple and straight out. It's clear, isn't it, from what I've already said to you, that, for example, the Gospel of Mark directly brings us in contact with Mark's thoughts and the thoughts of the community for which he was writing, let's say, Rome, 65 AD. Just like the painting that you paint of Mussolini doesn't tell me immediately about Mussolini, does it? But it tells me immediately about you and how you see Mussolini. Okay? So Mark's gospel takes us immediately in touch with that community. The skeptic historian would say that that's all you can really find out from the gospel. Really, all you've got is Mark, and while they write the gospel as narratives about Jesus, they are really interested in their own community, the interaction of their own community, the problem with the Jews and Gentiles and the Roman persecution of Nero and all that. And that's all in there, by the way, in the gospel. Of course they're interested in that, because otherwise they're not painting, are they? They're not alive. But they'd say that's all you can get. And the real Jesus of Nazareth, the Jesus before Christianity got hold of him kind of thing, is 35 years dead and lost, obscure, and you really can't know much about him. I want to attack that position for a moment and show that, no, somewhere in between the credulity of the fundamentalist and the historical skeptic lies the truth. One important thing I've already shared with you. The gospel writers say they are interested in Jesus. They say they're interested in Jesus. And when you think of it, it makes sense that they would have been. They weren't just interested in their own community, and their community would have had no sense and wouldn't have even been there apart from Jesus. He's the inspiration of it all, the meaning of it all, and there are many texts that show the desire to be faithful to the memory of the real Jesus in the text itself. So that's one thing to say. The second thing to say is that the Gospel of Mark and Matthew and Luke and John, the sources we're going to talk about, and the letters of Paul, weren't just one man's painting that happens to be extant, and so we think, oh, isn't that interesting? And I hope Mark was telling the truth. Mark's Gospel was accepted by the community who knew Jesus as authentic, as a gospel. There's another dozen written. Gospel according to Thomas, the Gospel according to everybody else. I'll give you the names later if I brought them down with me. I don't think I did. But there's another dozen gospels circulating in the second century at any rate that were not accepted. They were paintings, but they said, that's not good enough, mate, or that's not true enough, or that's a selection. That's not the Jesus we know. But when Mark wrote his, with Peter kind of breathing down his neck or encouraging him, Matthew pinched it in, you can see if you read Matthew, and produced it over in Antioch and added words to it. Luke, who was there with Mark when he wrote it, could well have been anyhow, because there's plenty of indication they were in Rome together. Luke said, oh, good, and he took a copy and didn't pay copyright or anything, and went over to the Greek and rewrote it, because he's writing to a different group. He painted it again, but he thought, what a beaut portrait. The church accepted this. The church that loved Jesus were martyred because they loved him. This is not just an extra little kind of little group they're going to join. Their life was on the line here. They accepted it. So that tells us a bit more about the validity of these sources. Thirdly, it's argued sometimes, theoretically, that love distorts, that there's a bias. If I love you, well, then I kind of see you through rose-colored glasses. Love is blind. Is that a statement some people make? The truth, you tell me the truth, but I would say love is the only thing that sees. Love may distort, but not only need it not distort, if you haven't got love, you don't see a person. Herod saw Jesus, Pilate saw Jesus, the Pharisees saw Jesus, but they didn't see him. They didn't see him the way Peter did. Or Mary of Magdala did. Not because Peter and Mary of Magdala are distorting the picture, but because they're open, and love enables you to be, doesn't it? To see another person truly. Because people are about relationships. They're not someone out there you can just decipher from a distance. And I don't have to prove that with you, I'm sure, but I just want to bring the point up. And you think in your own life, people that you weren't getting on with, and then one day something happened that threw you together, or they were hurt, or something, and they started to share something, and you started to realize who they were, and your compassion went out to them, and you found you loved them. Because you've been brought together into a... You haven't seen any more, almost. But some situation demanded an opening to that person, and it opened up a possibility of love that you didn't know was possible. The Gospels are given names, yes, and rightly. They're called theological history. They're not just, like, it's not just a social history of the time, and it's not just a biography of Jesus. They're theological history. In other words, the people who wrote them are interested in religious experience, because that's the way they met Jesus. And they're interested in looking at the meaning of the events of their life in the light of Jesus. Theology is faith experience seeking understanding. They were seeking to understand their life in the light of Jesus, and they were seeking to understand Jesus in the light of their own religious experience. Of course, yes. So it's a special kind of history, but very valid. In fact, the ultimate history, surely. They are called sometimes confessional history, because they aren't being cold and stiff upper lip and saying, well, actually it was like this and out there and objective, as whatever objective means. It needs a lot of defining. They wanted to tell people, hey, this is real, and we loved him and he's fair dinkum, and you better bloody believe it. They were real keen to share. So there's energy here, of course. They were confessing something. Does that make it any less history? Or does it perhaps point to the fact that the data that they're drawing on was exciting data about life? The fourth thing to say before I move to more important perhaps criteria that the scholars use is this, that let me take it then as a first glance that what we've got in Mark's Gospel, say, which will be one of our sources, or Matthew or Luke or John, is the impression Jesus made through the community upon Mark. or Matthew or Luke or John. Is that okay for a starting point? Even if that was all we had, at the very basis, even if that was all we had, that's a lot. Because if you're talking about a person, when you think of it, what is a person except someone, when you talk about a person's personality, you talk about how they relate to you, aren't you? Or to anybody, but to you if you're writing it. So a person is not a cold, hard data. We're talking about relationship. So what you mean to me tells me something about you. It tells anybody something about you, surely, because you're the one who means it to me. He is the reason for Mark's gospel. He's the inspiration of the portrait. And if he meant all that much to Mark, he must have been a kind of person to mean all that much to Mark and Matthew and Luke and John and Peter and Andrew and James. And he must have been someone who was worth crucifying. That tells you something about him, doesn't it? He must have been someone worth giving your life for. He must have been someone to change Mary of Magdala from being who she was to who she became to be. So, I mean, we can find out a lot about Jesus by what he meant to the people who painted the portraits of him. Furthermore, critical analysis in recent years has enabled scholars to discern in the written texts traditions from an earlier date. It's also possible to attain a high level of probability in regard to many of the things Jesus is said to have done and many of the things he is recorded as saying. Because of this, we can draw sound conclusions about his basic historical aims and even his own self-understanding. It's worth mentioning here some of the indications that provide persuasive evidence concerning the actual Jesus of history. So what I'm trying to do now is show, and this is what scholarship, a lot of it is all about, not just literary criticism, not just the artistic appreciation of the beauty of the portrait, but the portrait itself. People can discern behind it the photo. You can get back to much of the data that is the source of the artistically written text that we have. These are some of the criteria. Check them, see if they make sense to you. Think about them later and we can talk about it if you want to. For example, firstly, at times the gospel writer records something that poses problems both to himself and his community in relation to their understanding of Jesus. A prime example is Jesus being baptized by John the Baptist, for example. Each author in his own way goes to some pains to explain that it doesn't imply John's superiority over Jesus, which on the surface it would seem to imply. The only explanation of the text that we have is the basic fact that Jesus was actually baptized by John. They wouldn't make it up because they're trying to argue out of it. It's not a comfortable fact to deal with because it looks as though John the Baptist is the more important figure. Now, you don't, if you're going to paint a picture to make Jesus look good, you don't paint something that makes him look crook and then explain it away, do you? If you're making it up. The only possible explanation is that he was actually baptized, and therefore they had to work out a way of handling that that didn't make John look more important than Jesus. Likewise, his crucifixion, which was a scandal to them, that someone would be crucified, the Messiah, unthinkable thing to happen. So the only reason for being there is that it happened, and you can be historically totally sure it happened from this kind of criteria. Another indication, and these indications, it's the converging of all of them that eventually leads us with a lot of certainty. Another indication that we are in touch with the actual Jesus is when he's recorded as doing or saying something for which there's no precedent in Judaism of his time. No one would think to make it up. For example, his practice of sharing table fellowship with sinners. The Essenes didn't do it, the Pharisees didn't do it, the Sadducees didn't do it. It was unthinkable that you would have a meal with someone like that. Now, no one would even think of it. Jesus did it. And that was the shock of it. And it shocked them that he did it. And that was his meaning of doing it, of course, too. So we can be very confident that that extraordinary, unprecedented action can only be there not because it embellishes or brings out a certain point, but because of the shock of the actions that Jesus actually did back there 35 years ago. And they're trying to be faithful to that. Scholars alert us to certain of Jesus' idiosyncrasies, like his use of the intimate Abba for God. No one had ever done it, that intimate word for God, Abba. Or his use of the expression, Amen, 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 I say to you. It's an idiosyncratic way of speaking that goes back to the Aramaic and goes back to a human being, Jesus. Parables again. The parables as they stand in the Gospels are written for people in the last third of the first century. So just as I said earlier, if you're translating the meaning and you're talking, if you go into a classroom, you talk to kids of 6 years old, you talk in six-year-old language or whatever you do. I've never done it. It wouldn't be game. But you try and say it so that they understand you, or you wouldn't try. Or if you're talking to people in another culture, you'll try and do that, won't you? So obviously the parables as they are vitally interested in the actual situation of the church at the time they were written. Otherwise they're irrelevant. And you can very often tell that. But a parable has a certain shape, and it's hard to shift it. It's like one of those poems that have got so many lines and... I've got my memory, I've just got a sonnet has, 14 lines or whatever it is, a certain shape that it fits in. Well, if you find a sonnet with 15 lines, you can be sure someone added the line somewhere, because the sonnet itself, and so a parable has a shape and a history and a context and all that, and so the scholars can, with a lot of go back and pare away the church's thought and get back to the original parable with a lot of accuracy, as Jesus would have done it. Another criterion they use is the fact that there are Aramaic expressions in the Gospel. The Gospel is written in Greek, and someone came up with this expression the other night, she's apples, mate. Yeah. Okay. Well, if you were writing in French, and you were writing a book, and you said, and he said, elles sont des pommes, mes copains. See? A Frenchman would think, you know, because it is not a French expression, it means nothing. What the poem, what they're talking about, dude? But anyone who knew languages really well would say, oh, that's an Australian expression. You know, I bet he's just translated straight from Australian into French. He isn't translated well in that sense. When you look at the Gospel, there are a whole lot of what are called Aramaisms. Aramaic expressions that a Greek person would not use. The structure's wrong. The only reason for it can be that the person who writes it is so full of the Aramaic and doesn't want to tamper with it, and even risks writing bad Greek to get across as close as he can the feeling of Jesus. And so you can go back, not necessarily to Jesus' words, you couldn't prove that, but to an Aramaic original, and who else but Jesus. Finally, and there have been others, but I've given you a taste of them there that you can take away and think about, the most powerful indications of the historical data that are behind the editorial organization of the artistic historian that we're talking about, who gets it all together and shapes it into this portrait, the most powerful indications come from the convergence of probabilities. When we find certain attitudes, certain ideas, certain values appearing in all the different kinds of parables and miracles stories and healing occasions and Jesus preaching, when you find the same kind of attitudes and ideas and values occurring again and again from different and independent traditions within the various Gospels, the only reasonable conclusion is that they have their source in the real person who was the inspiration of all those various accounts. They all point back to the real person.